Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from Deviant Legion Network and, of course, Incredibly Strange Films and Film and Stuff. And today we have a very, very special episode. We're going to be talking about the exploitation director, Roberta Findlay, and we have a vast array of experts along with us. Before I introduce our first, which is Whitney Straub, I do want to say that Whitney and I had done a previous podcast with Jeffrey Escoffier, and unfortunately Jeffrey is no longer with us, so we want to dedicate this specific podcast to the memory of Jeffrey Escoffier. It is my pleasure to introduce Whitney Straub. Whitney is a author, and he just co-edited a book with his guest, Peter Alaloonis. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And Whitney looks at film from a very, very erudite and sort of like academic way. I'm really looking forward to this. So first, I'd like to introduce Whitney Straub. Whit, say hello and give us a little background.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Carl. It's good to be back here. And I'm really glad that we're dedicating this episode to Jeffrey, who is a good friend whose loss, you know, really, really continues to reverberate. Just to introduce myself, you know, I'm an associate professor of history at Rutgers University in Newark in New Jersey. And, you know, I write about obscenity and pornography within the context of film history and the history of sexuality. So I've written a few books. The first one was called Perversion for Profit and was mostly a political history of the rise of the new right, the sort of modern conservative movement that came out of the 1960s. And the ways that it mobilized around porn as an issue. And then one other book was Obscenity Rules, which is mostly a legalistic history of obscenity doctrine through the lens of the 1957 case Roth v. United States, which basically laid down the framework for obscenity as an exception to the First Amendment, confirming that, you know, materials deemed obscene don't have First Amendment protection, despite the seemingly categorical language of the First Amendment. So that's my background and, you know, in a nutshell. And then basically, you know, I've always been both not just a scholar of, you know, the sort of porn and exploitation film world, but also undeniably a sort of dorky fan. And, you know, those two tendencies kind of converge around a figure like Roberta Findlay, who on the one hand has this rich body of work that has generated its own pretty enormous fan culture and fan discourse that I'm certainly a part of. But separately from that, I think at an intellectual level represents a really fascinating figure on a variety of levels. I mean, the most obvious and simple one is simply gender. There were so few women filmmakers in the mainstream industry or the exploitation world during the time she was working from the 1960s to the 1980s that in and of itself makes her significant. But beyond that, her work has its own specific interest. You know, it's not just a matter of gender in some reductive and essentialist way. She was a really talented, vibrant, fascinating, you know, problematic and complicated filmmaker. And so all of that basically led to meeting up with my dear friend and colleague, Peter Alaloonis, who I think it's my job to introduce. So I've probably said enough. I'll just hand the floor over to Peter, who is an academic that I've really admired from afar, in the abstract. As this historian who was doing really fascinating work on adult video. And then later, fortunately, through kind of academic networks, we were able to connect and become good friends. And Peter wrote an essay for a book that I co-edited a few years ago, Porno Chic and the Sex Wars. And so this was an opportunity for us to work together with a bunch of people that we really like and admire as well to do the first academic book on Roberta Findlay. So maybe with that, Peter, you can take over.
Yeah, and let me just say how happy I am to be here and echo Whit in saying how happy I am this episode is dedicated to Jeffrey, who I only met once in person but was really struck in that one meeting by his generosity and kindness and his just overall grace, and what a towering figure in scholarship and just in the world. What a great person. So very happy that that's happening. I'm an associate professor of cinema studies at the University of Oregon in Eugene. And I specialize in adult film history and specifically the home video era. I wrote a book called Smutty Little Movies, the creation and regulation of adult video, which was probably the first academic full-length historical look at the adult video era. And I tried my best to cover as much as I could, although it's a huge history that I could really only scratch the surface of. Like Wit, my interests are in obscenity, technology, history, and I spend a lot of time thinking about the intersections of those things. And a real interest I have is in media that is overlooked or forgotten about or dismissed. And so it's a real natural fit for me to want to look at pornography and exploitation movies. And so when the University of Edinburgh Press came to me and said, would you like to do a volume in this series? I had seen our very good friend Finley Freibird and Alicia Cosma's book on Doris Wishman for them. And I was like, yes, immediately, with one caveat. And I said, I really only want to do it if my good friend Whit Strube will do it with me. And so they said, great. And then Whit said, great. And so here we are.
There you go. And I also like to introduce a regular contributor to Deviant Legion, someone who I just adore. He's a, I'm going to let him tell you who he is. Patrick, go ahead. And then afterwards, why don't you introduce Casey also?
Oh, I thank you. I was hoping you would talk me up, Carl, because following Whit and Peter, I feel like I don't have any of those.
You're a fan like I am, lobby. And I think that needs to be taken.
I'm a freelance writer from out of Oklahoma City and somewhat film historian and a sometime projectionist, and I basically write about filmmakers' careers and do career overviews on filmmakers that I like or find interesting. I've written extensively about Russ Meyer and Robert Altman, and I've begun doing a career overview on Roberta Finley and Bob Chin and Carlos Tobolina. So I also obviously write about adult cinema as well. And that's what I generally do. I just write, shoot my mouth off, and watch movies, and come onto this podcast, and I get to meet people and talk with you, Carl, which I always enjoy. But I invited along on this podcast because it's impossible, I feel, to talk about Roberta Finley without bringing also along Casey Scott, who is frequently does interviews and commentaries with Roberta. And, I mean, he really has just a – I mean, I'm just in awe of him, and I'll let him talk. But I'm just in awe of his ability to be on a personal level, bring so much out of her. So, and with that, I will let Casey take the floor.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm Casey Scott. I've been, I think most people know, my association with Roberta Finley started, I think about 17 years ago, maybe. It was a while ago, because I've done now, by my count, 9 DVD extras with her. I did an interview with her for the Babylon Pink release for Media Blasters. And then I was instrumental in getting her library saved and purchased by Vinegar Syndrome. I coordinated that collaboration between the two of them. And then I've been lucky enough to sit with her and to do commentaries on Anyone But My Husband, Fantasex, A Woman's Torment, Justine, A Matter of Innocence, Liquid Assets, Mascara, Prime Evil, Trick of the Mutilated, and we are supposed to be doing our next one, which I think will be number 10 in the next couple weeks for a title that has not been announced yet, and it might be our last because we're running out of negatives in her collection to restore for Blu-ray release, but never say never.
This is true. I must say I basically bow down to each and every one of you because I'm just a potzer compared to you. I just watch films And my introduction, well, not my introduction, but what really hit me was when I saw the Flesh trilogy, which of course she did with Michael. And just, wow. Wow. Just unbelievable. And from there on in, I saw Tenement in that. And of course, my background, Deviant Legion, I've written for a number of magazines also, but I bow down to each and every one of you. So I want to give it over to Whit and Peter and just tell us what the genesis of the book was and how it's organized, or, you know, and then I'm going to just leave it go from there and see where everyone wants to pop in. So go right ahead and start with that, Peter and Whit.
Yeah, so I guess after the press and I had a conversation about the project, I had a really lovely conversation with Whit, and we kind of instantly agreed this was a good idea, and we thought it might even be fun, which is rare sometimes in academia for a project to be both fruitful and fun. So our fingers were crossed, and we thought, let's go into this with that kind of a spirit, and then I have to say, it stayed that way pretty much through the project. And so I guess our first steps were looking for folks who wanted to contribute to the book, and we really lucked out and had really an elite roster of people who contributed essays, just some really wonderful scholars, Jen Moorman, Kevin Bazelka, Kayla Janice. I mean, these are people who, you know, and then of course the one that I'm especially happy about, I got to say, is Alexandra Heller-Nicholas, who had done some work on Roberta before. But Whit, I'm sure you can add to this, but we were just delighted with the folks who were in this.
Yeah. I think the one thing I would add is I think there's a longstanding tension, and I'm curious whether, you know, Pat and Casey, I think you'll agree with this, but disagree if you do, but there's a tension that's often there between sort of fan culture and scholarly culture when it comes to exploitation movies and adult cinema. And it's not super reductive. I mean, there are a lot of people, including many of us on this call, who are kind of planted in both camps, but it's still true that I think there's a little bit of siloing. There's a little bit of maybe distrust, maybe skepticism about the different approaches that the people take. And, you know, one thing we wanted to do was try to push on both fronts, you know, try to encourage folks who are, you know, big fans of these movies to think about what sort of theoretical and scholarly and academic approaches might add. And, you know, the answer might be nothing. I mean, that's totally valid and legitimate if people take a look at it and say, I couldn't care less about the relevance of Jacques Lacan to Roberta Finley. That's fair. You know, don't worry, the book is not heavily psychoanalytic in that way at all. But you know, we did want to encourage people to think in those ways. But at the same time, also to encourage academics to take seriously the real wisdom and knowledge that's come out of fan culture, especially since the internet. You know, obviously zines in the 80s were an incredible repository of knowledge, things like Sleazoid Express. But with the internet and the participatory culture that it's enabled, I mean, there's just so much knowledge and so much serious historical research. You know, I mean, it's a blog that realized that the CUNY student newspaper was digitized and found the 1961 article about young Roberta Finley playing piano at college in New York. And these are things that are, you know, often missed by scholars who just aren't necessarily thinking of this as a valid source of knowledge, I think. And so that was part of our goal, too, part of the kind of larger, you know, theoretical project was to really try to encourage folks in both camps to think about the knowledge and wisdom that exist on all sides of that spectrum.
Yeah, that's right. And I'll just add to that in Whit and I's work beyond this project, we tend to think that way anyway. We don't really discriminate in terms of how we do our historical research. And in fact, we kind of embrace that perspective. We like to dig around in those worlds and make those connections and alignments with people. So this project really gave us a chance to embrace that and kind of make it almost like one of the foundational principles of the project in a way.
Good. That gives us a good idea. Now, for me, I'm just going to let people know that the way I was introduced is I was very young. We moved to Bradford, Pennsylvania, and one of our customers at the music store ran the local drive-in. And so at 14 years old, I started, and really at 15, I really started working in the drive-in. And during those years, we did a lot of independent films. So the first things I ever saw that Roberto was connected to was Invasion of the Blood Farmers and Shriek of the Mutilated. You know, and so that's how I came, even though I didn't know who she was or that, that's how I came to it. Now, I'm going to ask Patrick and also Casey how they really got to, introduced to Roberta Finley and how that happened. So, Patrick, take it away.
I was introduced to Roberta Finley through Snuff. Actually, that's how I got to know her name, through the Psychotronic video guide, and then finally saw Snuff, and of course I didn't like it then. I kind of love it-ish now. But beyond Snuff, I know that I saw Tenement at an impressionable age. But in terms of her back catalog, the stuff she did with Michael, then her hardcore work, I had no real working knowledge of until just a couple of years ago. And I did also see Invasion of the Blood Farmers and Shriek of Mutilated as well. So I did see those at, again, 14, 15 on some, you know, VHS somewhere, and also through the Psychotronic guide, which featured them heavily. But that was my introduction to her. So it was not really directly even her. A lot of it was Michael's work, except for Tenement.
Right. Okay. And Casey, how did you get to know Roberta?
Mine was definitely through Something Weird Video. I think they're kind of like the gateway for a lot of us, for many different filmmakers. I think, you know, Doris Wishman, Herschel Gordon Lewis. So many other filmmakers. But Roberta, you know, I like you, saw the Flesh trilogy, and her name was always associated with working with Michael on those films. And when I first interviewed her, she immediately, like, put her guard up because, unfortunately, an author named Bill Landis had kind of harassed her incessantly about making these films with Michael. And so much so that she still doesn't answer her phone at her house. And so she was very defensive for years talking to anybody because she still insists today that she was not as involved in those movies as the credits will say. Like her name, Anna Riva, is all over these films. She was going to college at the time. So she may have been on the set, you know, helping her boyfriend, then husband, out. But I at this point, I'm more inclined to believe that she was not as involved as many have thought over the years. But as I followed their separate paths, Michael and Roberta, I realized that Roberta was definitely the more interesting filmmaker. Michael's films, separate from her, were really not very good. As it continued going into her R-rated films and then dug into her X-rated work, I just found film after film that I found really fascinating and incredibly well written, and her photography, which she's practically a self-taught photographer. She was the only working woman, actually handling a camera, in adult cinema, and actually I think American cinema for a long time. I just became completely enamored of her and her work. And then as I got to know her more as a person, she's one of my favorite people in the world. I'm so glad this book came out, and the interview that Witt and Peter did with her at the end of the book is absolutely incredible. And I will give praise to, I loved every piece in that book. I thought it was so fantastic. I definitely wanted to get the chance to say that if I didn't get a chance to say that later on in the show.
Okay, good. I'm going to pass it over. Well, basically at this point, I'm going to let it just go and let's talk about specific films. I will say when we get to Snuff, I do have a little story to say, but I'll wait until we get there. So do we want to start, you know, with some of the work she did with Michael, or do we want to go into her later stuff, however we want to do it. So I'll leave that to Whit. So Whit, where do you want to start here?
Yeah, sure. I have to say the thing that comes to my mind, and you're right, we could start anywhere, right? I mean, it's such a rich body of work, and every decade offers a whole set of different angles. But I've got to say, I mean, if I were pressed to sort of offer the definitive Roberta Findlay film, which I know is a sort of fool's errand to begin with, because, you know, that could vary on time of day or what period you're talking about. But I just will say the thing that jumped to my mind is A Woman's Torment, one of the hardcore movies that she made in the late 70s. And the reason for that, I think, is that it's a multiple set of reasons. I mean, one, it's a really powerful and evocative film. It gets the work done as a hardcore movie. It gives you the requisite, sex scenes and money shots, even if one of them is rather poorly faked. But it hits the generic marks of a hardcore film while also being this really agonized kind of existential feminist film in a way. And only in a way. I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about Findlay's work is that it doesn't distill down to sort of simple ideological or political messages. Here's a film that's essentially about how horrible it is to be a woman in heterosexual society dominated by brutal and negligent and obnoxious men. You can just see how that aligns with a lot of ideas coming out of 1970s second wave and radical feminism, these really serious critiques of our dominant institutions and of heterosexuality and heteromasculinity. And at the same time, before you can sort of rush to celebrate it, it's also this grimy exploitation movie coming from somebody who herself is a professed anti-feminist who hates women. So there's, there are all of these sort of paradoxes and contradictions that, for some filmmakers might undermine their work. You might say they're burdened by contradiction or muddled. But I think in her case, it really makes the work come alive. It sort of forces you to think about it and engage with the stuff that you're watching, even if you're some dude at a porn theater in 1977 who's just there to get his kicks. I mean, there's no way to avoid the sort of harshness of a lot of these movies, especially the ones that she was doing in the late 70s, I think, like that and Mystique and Beach House. So to me, that's a good starting point for just thinking about what she's doing in her filmmaking. And I will say one more thing before passing it off. I mean, obviously, Roberta herself is very cynical about her work, and she'll say, she was doing it to make a buck, to make a living. And that's obviously true. It's work, it's labor. And that's something that Peter and I really tried to emphasize, too, in the book, just thinking of her as a cultural worker. Once you're making a movie, even if you're making it for money, you're still going to imbue it with some kind of values and perspective. And so I think it's just a really rich body of work to sit with and unpack, and it doesn't lend itself to easy or simplistic or reductive interpretation.
Yeah, I agree with Whit, and I have to say I fell in love with A Woman's Torment. I think that movie is really good, and I think it also captures something about the frustration that I think even Roberta was probably feeling, but maybe was reluctant to talk about too much. But we did find where she said that movie was essentially her life story. I'm paraphrasing her a little bit, but she's even pointed that out. I really like that film, and I capture something. And I also want to say that Whit did a really masterful job in the introduction to our book, analyzing these different films she made that have all these sequences of very mediocre or downright disappointing sexual encounters, which is not something that's typically associated with adult films, but it's a motif that recurs in her films again and again. And I think, like Whit was saying a minute ago, if you imagine somebody in a 42nd Street theater just there to get their kicks, they're still being exposed to these really incredible and counterintuitive messages, which I think is a really nice touch in her films.
Pat, you got anything to say about Woman's Torment?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I probably think Woman's Torment, I just overdosed on Roberta Findlay movies, and I've seen that movie several times. And I tend to think that A Woman's Torment is probably her best work. It's an astonishing movie. And whenever I was watching her work in chronological order, what I found most interesting about it was, you know, up to that moment, up to a woman's torment, you know, there's a lot of madcap, zany comedies she did with Walter Sear that where the sex scenes aren't really dour or downbeat or, you know, they're joyous and raucous and, you know, it sort of belies the notion that she was terrible at shooting hardcore or her hardcore scenes couldn't raise the temperature. But you get to A Woman's Torment and there is literally nothing about that movie that is geared toward traditional, you know, what porn is for. I mean, that movie is almost anti-porn. And it's just beautifully acted, beautifully written. I love the cinematography in it. I love by that point in her career, that troupe of actors that she was working with, they were really in a groove. And I think she gets a lot of great performances out of everybody. And it's a shame that Tara Chung just sort of wandered off into the ether, because that is just an astonishing one-off performance.
Yeah, Tara Chung, she was in a few other movies. She was in a movie called Revenge and Punish. Oh no, was it Prey of a Call Girl? She was in another little quickie where it's a similar kind of performance where she's like a tortured woman seeking revenge against men, but it's very badly made. It's a Joe Dabion Ruffy for Avon Films. Woman's Torment, I mean, I have to echo the sentiments for that. That was, I think, the first that Vinegar Syndrome put out, and because it was a personal favorite of, you know, Joe Rubin, the co-founder of the company, and mine, that was something, that was the one we were most excited about finding when we were going through her negatives in my storage unit, in the same place where I had my storage unit in Lower Manhattan. But I think that film is getting a lot of great attention. You know, it's warranted attention because it is nice. It is beautifully restored on the Blu-ray they put out. Unfortunately, two films she made around the same time in the same location, which are Mystique and Tiffany Minx, those negatives are long gone. So I think I might like Mystique a little more than Woman's Torment. That's an interesting case as well, because that's a script that they purchased from Roger Watkins, that she and Walter Sear purchased from Roger Watkins. He is not credited on the film, and when I spoke to him before he passed away, he was still very bitter about that. And he claimed Roberta stole the writing credit, but there is no writing credit on that film. So he was still mad about it. But that film is a really beautiful story. It's rough and violent in certain places, but about a woman dying of cancer who goes to the beach to be alone and die and develops a strange relationship with Samantha, with this woman who seems to come out of the surf. And it really includes a lot of fascinating references to her background in classical music. The soundtrack has a lot of Wagner operas. The characters are named after heroines in Wagner operas. So that I think is maybe one of the definitive Roberta Finley films. And unfortunately, I wish more people were aware of it, and I wish it would reach a larger audience. It's one that we're still trying to find better elements for that, because it's such a really gorgeous movie.
Agreed, by the way. I agree 100%. And I actually got to say, I'm sorry to ruin it, but the Tiffany Minx runs a close second for me. I mean, Mystique's in my top five, but all three of those movies are just incredible, and I'm really sad to hear that the negative for the Tiffany Minx is lost, because the only way I could watch it was in German with no English subs. So I knew the plot, I knew the story, but I had to watch it. You know, that's the way I had to watch it, and that score is incredible. That, oh my God.
Well, one of the things I've noticed in this conversation is that Roberta put a lot of emphasis not only on the acting and her point of view, but also the music in that. So she's looking to be in, to have a say in the total control of the film. Now, we've been talking about specifically her hardcore output. Is there any softcore or sexploitation or, you know, exploitation film that you would recommend of her of war that some people may not want to get into the hardcore. So let's just take that question and see where we go with that.
Yeah, sure. Whit here. I will say Rosebud, which is another of these lesser known films that is not in good, clean commercial circulation in a pristine copy. I do think summarizes, it goes back to some of what Casey was talking about. You know, here's a film from 1972, really, you know, verging on hardcore without exactly, you know, and we could argue over what defines hardcore, I suppose, but it's not quite a hardcore movie in the conventional sense, although pretty close. But it definitely, you know, I think one of the things Casey flagged that's really important in kind of understanding Finley is, you know, she does have this background in not just music, but kind of high culture and also middlebrow culture. It's always fascinating to look at to kind of track the genealogies of these different hardcore filmmakers in the 70s. You get a lot of like Ingmar Bergman influenced existentialists, you know, I think with Joe Sarno and even Gerard Damiano kind of fit that model. And you get the kind of radical transgressive underground folks like Fred Halstead. But Roberta's influences really are, you know, kind of classic Hollywood and classical music. You know, she loves Billy Wilder and William Wyler, Howard Hawks. And she had no interest in lowbrow cinema. You know, she was not going to watch movies on 42nd Street for fun. And so Rosebud, I think, captures a lot of that with it. You know, it's set up like basically an 18th century epistolary novel, you know, novels that are told through letter writing. And it's got a real sort of poignant beauty to it, even as at the same time, it's basically a crude sex movie. And she's also very invested in sort of psychological discourse at this point. A lot of, you know, that and Altar of Lust in the early 70s are very much about psychosexual damage and trying to unpack that, but all within the guise of an exploitation movie. So anyway, just to jump in on that.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to say really quick, it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, I fully agree her interest in the highbrow. And in that way, she kind of reminds me of an alternate version of Radley Metzger, because Metzger was a Europhile into high culture and art and everything like that. But he was a real snob about it. And Roberta, it takes the other way and is incredibly self-deprecating and is like, well, these movies were garbage. I made them, you know, for money or whatever. And she kind of pretends that she didn't take any kind of pride in what she was doing. But when you watch her work, it's clear that she did put everything she had into it, whether she'll admit to it now or not.
Okay, Pat, do you have any film that you would recommend that isn't hardcore for Roberta's that you would recommend?
I mean, do we count Janie as hers, or is that more Jack Bradman? Or because I love Janie, I think Janie is incredible. And it's softcore. I think that Janie is kind of a favorite of mine because Roberta is in it, and gives a really fun performance as this, kind of trashy mother-in-law that Janie strangles with a belt. And it's got this incredible score, again, with the music in her movies. I adore Janie. That's the one of her softcore films. That's what I would recommend if we do, in fact, count that as hers. It doesn't feel like Michael, for sure.
Well, what I can tell you is that IMDb does credit her as co-director with that, with Jack Bradman. So, you know, I guess we can count that.
It all depends.
I don't know what
Whit
or Peter would say.
I'm trying to remember if we talked about someone with her. I don't think we did. Whit, did we?
No, I don't think so. We asked about Take My Head from the right at the same moment, 1970, and I don't think she so much denied making that as maybe didn't even remember it existing. It looked like it took about an hour to shoot, and it's got Mike's fingerprints on it. But yeah, I don't know. I would defer to Casey on this one.
For JD, I think she would probably say that was Bradman's movie. Well, I don't know, and that's the thing. It's, you know, she's also not an attention hog. So, like, Liquid Assets, she's credited on that, or Robert Walters is, but she says it's Walter Sears' movie because she's like, I shot it and Walter directed it. So I think she'd probably say it was a Bradman film. And maybe that's the thing would take my head. I mean, she might have done some photography on it, but I think at that point it was around that period when she was in her learning. She was in the learning mode where she was trying to learn. I think it was before they went to South America to make snuff as well for both of those.
Okay, so I want to get into a period of time we haven't talked about yet with her. And this is where I know a lot of her later work, and particularly Tenement, which I think is one of the sleaziest and most wonderful exploitation films I've seen. But if we talk about her 80s output, both sexploitation and also just exploitation, is there any film that you would really recommend for that period of time and her later in the 80s decade?
Well, I was just about to say, actually, that I wanted to put a little plug in for Tenement myself, because I think that movie is it's like a blistering, sleazy, jaw-dropping. I never get tired of watching it. And every time I watch it, I just discover something completely new that makes my jaw drop even more. I really have a deep love of those grimy movies of that era about New York City in particular. And that one really has always stood out to me. Earlier when you were saying, how did everybody here kind of get exposed to Roberta's work? That might have been the first Roberta film I saw many years ago. I think I just rented it cold at a video store and took it home and was just completely, my mind was melted by it. So to come back to it all these years later for this project was be great.
So one of the things I do have to say about that period of time is that I moved to New York City in 1981, and the Deuce was definitely on the decline. But and we talk about snuff, and I had a friend of mine who was one of the people who were hired to be a fake protester when it was running. And I got to see that in one of the theaters. But I also got to see Tenement while I was there, and I was just like blown away. I didn't see it on a Deuce. I saw it at the Broadway Theater, which is the old theater up in Astoria, Grindhouse Theater. And just blew me away. Just so sleazy and just so nasty and just so wonderful. And you say you can watch that film time and time again and see different things. Now, I've only seen it twice, okay, and I still see scenes from it in my head. It's just unbelievable what power there is in that film. So, Pat, do you want to say anything about Tenement? Because I know you like it too.
Oh, yeah, I love Tenement. It's almost like it makes for such a great double bill with the Assault on Precinct 13. It's a great siege movie. They're both, you know, I love the way they're structured. And like you said, the thing about Tenement, every time I watch it, I seem to have missed something because there's always a lot going on. And because Roberta shoots her stuff so sort of unconventionally, and the way it's edited is a little unconventional, it doesn't register like a sort of traditional mainstream Hollywood film would. So Tenement is one. It's sort of a present that keeps on giving with each repeat viewing. And I adore that movie. I absolutely love it. I watched it today, as a matter of fact.
There you go. And that's a ringing endorsement if I ever heard one. Okay, so I'm just gonna toss it back to you guys and talk about what you want. So take it away, Whit.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I'll jump on the Tenement bandwagon quick because I'm actually standing in my room while we're talking here looking at my DVD shelf. And, you know, it makes me think of this whole set of films from early to mid-1980s New York, right, like Basket Case, Combat Shock, Riot on 42nd Street, Street Trash. I'm just reading titles here, but they clearly form a pretty cohesive body of work, right, which, you know, I think the defining feature of it is just that it makes such vivid sort of tactile use of the city, which is something that gets lost as, you know, budgets shrink and both horror and porn movies really sort of move toward a set-bound approach. And Roberta's own films, I think, show some of that. I mean, her later horror movies are just clearly not as much of a live wire as Tenement when you get to Lurkers and Primeval and especially Blood Sisters. I mean, she's kind of, and by her own account, you know, she's phoning some of these in, like Blood Sisters she made because her accountant said that they had to, like, spend some money quick before, you know, it would save them money on their taxes. And so she turned out this movie, and it's not without its minor charms, but it's just very clearly not possessed of the same kind of raw energy as Tenement or that other body of films that were kind of its contemporaries. So yeah, I think, you know, and we do have an essay in the book about the horror movies. And Johnny Walker, who writes about VHS horror and the video market in the UK, but also in America, I think his take on it is a good one. I mean, he takes an industrial approach to these films. In other words, they're not that interesting as films unto themselves. You know, they're sort of minor, enjoyable B-movies. But he really looks at them and looks at Roberta's making of them as reflecting larger trends within the industry. And she herself is pretty open about that. You know, she acknowledged that the video market really knocked the wind out of the circulation of adult films on film in theaters, and that was a driving force in leading her to the horror. So it's always kind of fun to watch them from that point of view, you know, thinking of them through the lens of their production and sort of historical context. I mean, you've got to be a particular kind of nerd, I think, to do that, obviously, but I suspect all of us here and anybody listening to this probably fits that bill. So anyway, yeah, that's just what comes to mind for me is the different kind of approaches one might take to some of these minor works.
Whit, I was just thinking about what you were saying about New York City as an environment, and this might resonate with you too, but I grew up in a very small town, very far away from New York City. And so the New York City in those films you mentioned became kind of an imaginary for people who had never been there. And so in my case, when I finally did go to New York City around that time in the mid-80s for some sort of family vacation or something, my only knowledge about the place was from those films. And so when I got there, I didn't know what to expect because that was kind of the imaginary place in my mind. So I think that adds a layer too of a sort of a historical layer that all of those films, including Tenement, create this space that exists even beyond the movies and into the imagination.
Well, if I could pop in here for a second, my former partner, who is Stephen Ronquillo, who I still work with occasionally, we've always wanted to do a show about the place in film and how they are a document of a specific time in a specific place. And the one I always go to when I was in New York, I was working for a woman, Carla Pinta, Latino playwrights, and her second in command was up in the South Bronx, okay, which at that point in time was like post-World War II France. And I point to the beginning of Wolfen because Anna, who was the second in command, lived not three blocks from there. And that I specifically saw that particular spot that they filmed Wolfen on, and it was just like blew my mind. And of course I also hung out in the East Village, and that was post-World War II France too, so you know it's like good block bad block type of thing, you know. And so if you see all the bad blocks in film, that's what you think you're going to get into. Okay, but enough of me. Let's go back and let's talk more about Roberta's films. So is there a film that we haven't mentioned that you guys want to mention?
You'd asked previously if there were any of her softcore films that I'd recommend. I really like The Clam Digger's Daughter, which she's a little dismissive of. It's kind of her version of Romeo and Juliet. And it was made with Alan Shackleton, the sleazeball who produced Snuff, who bought it from who bought the slaughter from Michael and Roberta and then transformed it into snuff. And then she was in a relationship with him that ended very badly. That was probably the best film she made for him before Angel on Fire or Angel Number 9. And it stars a real life couple. It's Eric Edwards and Chris Jordan, who were married at the time. And it was shot in, Amityville.
Uh-huh.
That's a really good one. I don't know like a lot of her films, I don't know how easy it is to get a hold of now, because Something Weird Video had it available, and once they discontinued almost their entire catalog, I don't know where you'd get a hold of Clint Digger's Daughter now.
Because one thing is, when I was at the drive-in, that was one of the films that Howard showed, and I loved it. But I also got a chance to talk to Eric Edwards and have an interview with him on the podcast here. And he talked about Roberta as a director and how he was just absolutely blown away how good she was. So I did want to at least say that too, but I'm glad you mentioned Clam Digger's Daughter. Okay, enough. Going back to films, anyone else want to mention films that we haven't mentioned? Pat?
I'm glad, Case, you mentioned The Clam Digger's Daughter, because that is actually good. That's Something Weird. The print they have is just in really rough shape. And that's one that I wish could get restored, because, to a larger point, what makes Roberta Findlay such a great filmmaker, she's a great New York filmmaker, but she doesn't just shoot, she can shoot all kinds of different areas and really bring them out. And, I mean, like, her stuff in Shriek of the Mutilated is really beautiful, the exteriors. I mean, she really was such a great, great cinematographer. And The Clam Digger's Daughter is especially well shot. It's a really gorgeous – I can tell that it's a gorgeous film, even though that transfer is absolute trash. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I did want to say that, that was one thing that I was noticing while going through all of her movies, is just, her Fire Island films, her, her movies that are shot maybe upstate, her downtown films, her films that are shot in Paris, stuff, Skylines. She is just a really, really, she was a really gifted cinematographer, really. And hats off to her.
I've got to jump in with a quick Clam Digger's Daughter story, because I don't know if you guys know this. I know, we've got some serious Findlay experts here. But in case you're not aware, there's a theater troupe in Massachusetts, Pirates Lane Video is their Vimeo account. They actually did a stage version of Clam Digger's Daughter directly based on the film. It actually begins with a projection from the film. It's obviously not as sexed up as the film. It's sort of stripped down into a more family-friendly fare. But it's just kind of bonkers to know that it exists. It's kind of hanging in obscurity on Vimeo, but you can find it by Googling Clam Digger's Daughter, Pirates Lane, and it's about an hour long. It's really enjoyable. I can't really fathom what the audience for it was, other than hardcore Roberta Findlay fans. But more power to them. I'm delighted that it exists. So I thought I'd shout that out quick.
Oh, that's great! I'll look for that.
Yeah, I need to see that. Well, that kind of reminds me how there was, when they did, there was an art collective that did kind of a revamp of John Alamomero's Bacchanal with a new score, I think. And that kind of makes me think, I wonder what someone could do with, like, Chuck Vincent's Visions, if there was a good version of that, because Roberta shot that. And it's kind of like Chuck's version of Satyricon. And it stars Wade Nichols, a.k.a. Dennis Parker, who was a disco singer and the star of Takeoff for Armand Weston. But her photography in that is just gorgeous. And that, you're absolutely right. I think a lot of the talk about Roberta as a director is, of course, warranted and everything. But looking at her work as a photographer for other directors is just as interesting. Because, she shot Blonde Ambition for John and Lemomero. She did Visions for Chuck Vincent. She shot Platinum Paradise and Babylon Pink for Howard Winters. And Babylon Pink is particularly stunning. I mean, she makes Vanessa Del Rio the best she's ever looked, I think, in Babylon
Pink. Absolutely. I just got yeah. That is like one of my top five favorite hardcore films of all time. I fucking love Babylon Pig. So enough for me. Go ahead.
Well, I think that says it. But yeah, so I think she even in her horror films, which I think we can all agree aren't the best, she really takes great care in that lighting and working with shadows and light. So I think she said before that, you know, her first love was photographer, her second love was lighting. And she really loves working with those lights, and it shows. It really pays off, I think.
Nice. All right, so we're getting on to the end of the hour. We can go a little further. I don't mind if you guys want to stick around. But again, let's just go around the table and, like, again, any other films or anything else you want to mention about Roberta? We'll start with Casey because you talked to her specifically. So
yeah,
just give us
you
some
know,
insight.
I think. First of all, I would encourage everyone to pick up a copy of this book. I read it in the course of 2 days. I devoured it. I loved it. I was, to be completely honest, I was supposed to be a part of this book, and I had to bow out for personal reasons. But I don't think anything I could have done could have equaled anything that's in this book. It's just one great piece of writing after another. But I will say, you know, it's interesting because the introduction to the book is by Joe Rubin from Nick Vinegar Syndrome, and he talks about when, you know, he and I and Roberta and one of her employees at the sound studio went to this storage unit to look at her elements. But the story of how the elements even got there is fascinating, and I'll make it quick. But they were being kept inside a wall in a museum in Brooklyn. And I've been trying to shop these films around to different distributors for a couple of years because I wanted to get Roberta some money for these movies. So I knew Ben Mickerson was interested, and that offer was on the table. Well, she got a call from the owner of the building, who she'd known for years, and said, "So, Roberta, I forgot your stuff is in the walls of this building. This building's getting torn down tomorrow. So, like, what do you want to do with these things?" So Roberta grabs the phone, hires a truck, has them unload all of those negatives from inside a wall in a building in Brooklyn, and then rents a storage unit at a place she's never been. She does it all over the phone. They dump all that stuff in the storage unit, and then we have to go and parse through it and see what the heck was in those walls in Brooklyn. So it really is like, that's the kind of story. It's like, it's rescuing these films that would have been completely lost otherwise. And that's how I knew Roberta actually gave a crap. Because it was not just about the money either. Because there were movies that were missing in the negatives, and she looked crestfallen that there was stuff missing. So that was quite an experience. So I'm just glad that the films are available again for more people to see.
Good. So, Pat, anything else you want to say?
Well, I want to say that, yes, the this book is absolutely terrific. I got my copy last night, and I went through and read through the opening. I got to the first essay. I was very tired, so I'm going to be, after tomorrow, I've got the day, and I'm going to be reading it. Because, you know, it just a really, really well done. And always, you know, with Roberta, it's always like every time I read an interview with her or hear one of these commentaries that Casey has moderated or anything, I tend to seem to learn something new that also contradicts something that I felt that I knew before. So this week I'm now dealing with the fact that now she didn't direct Dear Pam, I guess, is what I'm learning from this interview and this book. So it's always new information. I always, you know, and that's always fascinating to me. But the essays themselves, I thumbed through some of them. And, yeah, just really, really wonderfully done. Congratulations to everybody.
Okay, Peter and Witt, last thoughts?
Well, yeah, just thank you for those really kind and generous comments. And Casey, we just respect you so much and the work that you've done. And it just means a lot to hear those compliments from both of you. Thank you so much. It was really a total pleasure to do this project and to do it with such a good friend, Wit, and all these great contributors to this book, and to just to revisit all of Roberta's films and her life, and to just keep some of that stuff alive for people to discover. I mean, that's really, like, extremely gratifying. So it was a real pleasure.
All right, Wit?
Yeah, basically same. You know, I obviously think it would have been ever so slightly better, you know, Casey, with you included. So it does, you know, mean a lot that it won your respect, because you are definitely one of the definitive experts. You know, I'll say two quick things in closing. I mean, one is, you know, going back to what Pat said about clarifying some of the directorial credits. I've got to say, and we did have Walter Sears' grandson, Derek Gaskell, also wrote a chapter on their collaboration, which is great because, you know, it wasn't just nepotism. He's an actual scholar of pornography himself, who happens to have a nice inside view on some of this. And it was kind of a bitter irony for me, because one of my favorite kind of gonzo comedy Finley movies was Slip Up, which it turns out she didn't even do. You know, I had long thought she had. It actually made aesthetic sense to me even that she would have, but turns out not. That was a Walter Sear production. But one of the things that lingers and haunts me from working on this book is one of her lost movies. You know, there are a few that have fallen through the cracks. And in 1967, her and Mike went to Belgium and made this bonkers-sounding movie called Eroticon, which was described as the psychoanalytically based stories of the fantasy of a man as he is dying of a suicide attempt, and he apparently goes into some kind of gay panic. It sounds fascinating, and customs confiscated it, and it led to a court trial that was covered in Variety in 1968, and then the film just disappeared from the face of the earth. You know, I don't have any idea where one would find a surviving copy, if there is one. Obviously, I went to Joe Rubin, who's one of the people you would go to with this question, and he didn't really have any leads, which really is, you know, the sign of a dead end. But I'm hoping, you know, unlikely, but still hoping, that kind of like some of these Andy Milligan movies that wash up now and then in even piecemeal form, that somebody might find this movie, because it sounds like a sort of crucial addition to the Roberta and Michael Finley oeuvre.
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
It's the U.S. government, because you know the customs still has it somewhere.
Yeah,
probably.
You're right. I mean, that's actually worth looking into.
Yeah, it is.
Well, you never know. They find things, you know, they keep finding things that you thought were lost. I mean, I guess they now found London After Midnight. So, you know, you never know. So Wit and Peter, for our listeners, can you please say the name of the book and where we can get it and all that sort of good stuff? And let's give you a chance to promote.
Yeah, thank you. The name of the book is Refocus, the Films of Roberta Finlay. It's part of the Refocus series from the University of Edinburgh Press. It's available anywhere you buy books online. It's also available probably directly from the press. Right now, it's available only in the hardback, or what we call the library edition, which is pretty expensive, but it will be released in paperback later this year.
Okay, and for me, I'm waiting for the paperback. I hate to say that, but just letting you know.
No, I completely understand. It's, yeah.
But, okay, and why don't you tell us some of the other books that you've done and so on and so forth, both of you. So go ahead, Wit.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like I said at the start, really briefly, you know, I've written two books, Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right, and Obscenity Rules, which is about the Roth v. U.S. case in obscenity law. And before this, I co-edited with Carolyn Bronstein the book Porno Chic and the Sex Wars, about 1970s kind of sexual representations in American culture. The next thing I've got coming on the road at the end of the calendar year is an edited collection on Queer Newark, about LGBTQ history here in North New Jersey, which is where I live and work. So a slightly different framework, but, you know, connected in terms of being about the history of sexuality and kind of recovering some marginalized and lost stories.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm the author of Smutty Little Movies from the University of California Press. And, You could also catch me right now live on the Vice TV series called Sex Before the Internet, which is airing. The episode 2 was this week, and they'll resume next week. And I'm a talking head on that series, which is kind of fun.
Oh, cool. Cool. So we get to know what you look like, too. That's a good thing. And Patrick, come on. Talk to us about the Apollo Theater and what you do there.
Oh, well, you know, the Apollo Twins been quiet ever since, you know, I've been doing these deep dives into Bob Chen and Roberta Finley, but I'll be back. I've been doing a lot of other stuff, and I'm not ready to announce it yet, but I've just been sort of involved in a lot of stuff that's kept me very busy and kept me from, like, posting like I was, where I was posting 3 times a week and stuff. But I still post occasionally over at apollotwin.com, and I still plan to do some posts and maybe some Roberta Finley's and Bob Chen's and stuff that I have been writing lately. But there's possibly bigger news on the horizon coming in the first quarter of this year.
Well, let me tell you something. As soon as you know that, I better know that so we can promote it. Okay?
Oh, yes. Well, I'll be shooting my mouth off everywhere about that. And
Casey, give us a little promotion on what you've been doing.
Well, I'm still doing extras for Vinegar Syndrome's X-rated releases, and you know any other exploitation or horror extras that they need. I have some interesting ones coming up for. I have some scheduled for a John Christopher film, which will be announced soon. I have another Roberta commentary coming up. I'm supposed to do an interview with Colleen Brennan and a few other people. So that's. You know, that kind of keeps my feet in the pool as I work on a long gestating book on the history of adult films that I've been working on for, some would say, too long. But it's a continued work in progress. And I love finding people and talking to them about their experiences in this industry, but both good and bad, because, you know, multifaceted industry for sure.
Absolutely. And for us at Deviant Legion, I just got to say, it's been an absolute pleasure to do this. Now, before I get into what we call housekeeping, I do want to reiterate that this particular episode is dedicated to the memory of Jeffrey Escoffier, who I met when Whit and him were on about a show about gay pornography. And I really, really just people to know also – you know, his Facebook page is still up. And if you don't know who he is, check into Jeffrey. He was a really good guy, and we really miss him a lot. As far as what we're doing here on Deviant Legion, I will tell you a couple things that are happening. Okay. So on Sunday, Rock This Town Radio with TC, he was going to do this last week, but it had to be basically – put aside until this week. He's going to be doing the songs of 1968. Of course, this is the year that both Martin Luther King Jr. and also Robert Kennedy were assassinated. So that is our nod to that particular year. On Tuesday, Rachel and I will be back with a rabbit hole. And Rachel and I are going to go down the rabbit hole on discontinued foods. And some of the things we love that are no longer with us, like the Choco Taco and various other things. So we'll talk about that. Doc will be back on Wednesday with Voices from the Bog. And on Friday the 27th, Adam Ferenc will be here with the Cathode Ray Mission, and they're going to be doing a guest panel on the TV series Homicide: Life on the Street. And that's what we've got set for Deviant Legion. Again, I want to thank everybody who was here, Whit, Peter and Casey, and of course, Patrick, who's been on a number of times. You're all welcome to come back. Please let us know what you're doing. We'd love to have you on. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, so at least I think at this point in time, It's time for us to say good night. So thank you very much, guys. Thanks for listening, everyone. And let's say good night, everyone. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Yes. Good night, John Boy. Come on, guys. All right. Good night.